This meeting is now being recorded.
Go ahead and get started, Ms. Cuera. Thank you.
Terrific. Thank you, everybody, for joining us today. We are convening yet another meeting of the Language Access Plan Implementation Task Force. This is probably meeting number 13 or 14, a public meeting. I want to remind you to please not put us on hold because everyone might hear your court's background music, and however nice it is, we'd prefer not to hear it. Please also put your phone on mute to minimize background noise, and remember to say your name before speaking so we know who you are. I am going to turn it over to Elizabeth for our roll call, but let me just make one observation, which is we are really delighted to just reflect on how many of these meetings we have had, how well they've gone, how fortunate we've been to get such good and helpful input from task force members and from the public. So with that, let's turn it over to Elizabeth for roll call.
Thank you, Justice Cuera. Judge Covarrubias. Judge Covarrubias. Naomi Adelson. Judge Austin.
Here.
Kevin Baker. Angie Birchfield.
Here.
Thanks, Angie. Tracy Clark.
Here.
Judge Conklin.
Here.
Judge Court.
Here.
And just to note, Judge Court, I believe you need to leave the meeting at 12:40.
Yes, that's right.
Thank you. Judge Gard.
Thank you.
Yes, hi.
Anna Maria Garcia. Susan Marie Gonzalez, not able to join us. Judge Hayashi.
Here.
Janet Houdet.
Here.
Joanne Lee.
Here.
Is Yvette Pena on the line? I know she sent me a note that she may be running a little late. Yvette? Okay. Justice Pena.
Here.
Thank you. Justice Renner?
Here.
Mike Roddy.
Present.
Judge Rodriguez.
Here.
Dr. Valdez is not able to join us. Jose Barella. Judge Walsh is not able to join us. David Yamasaki.
Here.
Justice Zelon.
Here. Here.
Thank you. Did anybody else join the meeting after your name was called?
Hi, I'm sorry. This is Anna Maria Garcia. I joined late.
Thank you, Anna Maria. Appreciate it.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Elizabeth. This is Kevin Baker.
Thanks, Kevin. And we do have a quorum, Justice Cuera.
That's always good news. Thank you very much, Elizabeth, and thank you, everybody, for joining us. So today will likely be it's kind of a fateful meeting because it's our last full meeting in all likelihood of the task force as we prepare to sunset on March 1st, 2019. But language access is like the British Empire in the sense that the sun never sets for language access, so we have a lot of ongoing projects to move forward on in the next couple of months, weeks, and the most important thing that we have to do in addition to the topics that we're going to discuss today, which are very important, is to prepare for a transition to a new body that the Judicial Council has already approved that is going to get the torch that we've been carrying on language access, and I'm really delighted to report on that. So as you may have heard, on December 17th, 2018, you might remember, we approved a resolution supporting the formation of this standing language access subcommittee under our Providing Access and Fairness Committee for the Judicial Council. And I'm very happy to report that this structure was approved by the Judicial Council on January 15th, a couple days ago. And I'm really quite confident that the structure is going to serve the public well, especially if all or some of you stay involved in the issue, which I hope that you will, either through the subcommittee or otherwise. So we're going to be working hard in the next couple of days to get this new subcommittee up and running because it will be responsible for implementing all the things that we have been working on, continuing that process, and also making sure that all the recommendations that we have not had a chance to finish implementing get the attention they deserve. We hope that this whole effort will basically mean that there will be no gaps, that it'll be pretty seamless going from the task force we have the high-profile attention it's gotten to a new body that's going to have responsibility to continue all this work. But for today, we want to focus on three things, really two that are most important. We're going to go through the approval of the task force minutes pretty quickly, hopefully, and then we're going to turn to two fairly significant issues, review and hopeful approval of the draft VRI report for the Council's March 2019 meeting, and then review and hopefully approval of a set of bilingual volunteer protocols for court volunteer programs that can be then posted in the Language Access Toolkit. So let me start just briefly with the minutes. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes from December 17, 2018?
Judge Covarrubias.
Okay. I heard Judge Covarrubias. Do I have a second?
I will second.
Thank you. Great. Any further discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
All right. Any against? Abstentions? The minutes are approved. So now, just to make sure we use our time as efficiently as possible, we're going to go straight into the discussion of the VRI experience and report. So I'm going to turn it over to David Yamasaki, who is the chair of our Technological Solutions Subcommittee. David.
Thank you very much, Mr. I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to present this item as it relates to the VRI pilot project. And the activities of the subcommittee, which were very ably led by Justice Bruniers, and I'm kind of pinch-hitting right now because of the great work that he's already undertaken. Today, what I want to do is go over the draft Judicial Council report on the VRI pilot, which has been posted to the task force webpage. The report includes draft recommended guidelines for VRI for spoken language interpreted events, including guidelines for recommended technology requirements. The report also includes the final pilot evaluation report from San Diego State University Research Foundation and comments received in December 2018 from California Federation of Interpreters, CFI, Interpreters Guild of America, IGA. And following my introduction of the report, we'll have time to answer questions. So I'm going to jump right into it. As an overview, while of course in-person certified and registered court interpreters are preferred for court proceedings, the Language Access Plan, LAP, adopted the Council allows courts to consider the use of remote interpreting where it is appropriate for a particular event if it will allow LAP court users to fully meaningfully participate in court proceedings. And they're identified in LAP Rec number 12. The LAP also recommended that the Judicial Council conduct a VRI pilot, LAP Rec number 16. The goals of the VRI pilot project included evaluating equipment solutions, defining statewide technical minimum standards, validating LAP VRI programmatic / usage guidelines, also included in the LAP appendices B through D, collecting relevant data on due process issues and participant satisfaction, and finally establishing leveraged purchase agreements with vetted equipment vendors so courts have an efficient method to expand access using approved video remote interpreting solutions. The six-month VRI project started on February 1 and ended on July 31, 2018. There were two vendors that participated. One is Parson Associates and Connected Justice Consortium, both of whom qualified under the Judicial Council's RFP process, and they both used Cisco equipment, which were selected for the six-month pilot. The VRI pilot was evaluated by San Diego State University Research Foundation, which is a third-party independent evaluator. Three pilot courts participated in the pilot project. Courts were Merced, Ventura, and Sacramento, representing small, medium, and large courts, respectively. Data collection took place throughout the pilot. Following the conclusion of the pilot, staff worked with vendors, the pilot courts, the independent evaluator, and the National Center for State Courts to gather findings and develop recommendations for the Judicial Council. Before I continue, I would be remiss if I didn't thank the three pilot courts, Merced, Sacramento, and Ventura. All of the judges, court staff, and court interpreters from those three courts who worked so hard on the pilot last year. Judicial counsel staff have also put in many hours on this project. I'll say also that we had a very good opportunity to observe the program itself at a recent meeting in Sacramento, and that was especially helpful for those who did not have as much information on how the system worked to get a good first-hand look of its functionality. Now, on to the findings. The overall pilot findings are positive and are summarized beginning on page 5 of the council report. Due process concerns were raised for LEP persons who were primarily assessed by evaluating the communication effectiveness of the VRI equipment and by reviewing data collected during and after the pilot from key stakeholders. 95% of the surveys completed by judicial officers indicated that judicial officers determined VRI allowed for effective communication between the LEP court user and the courtroom. Approximately 59% of post-pilot survey respondents, which included court interpreters, determined that VRI allowed LEP court users to meaningfully participate in court proceedings. The VRI equipment also received high marks from LEP court users for satisfaction and ease of use. Both vendors, Connected Justice and Parson Associates, scored well on technical aspects and were approved to go forward. Because the pilot used court employee interpreters, it was not able to compare or establish any cost savings from the use of VRI. Speaking of guidelines and minimal technical requirements, the VRI guidelines in Attachment A are based on existing VRI guidelines in the LAP. They now have recommended minimum technology requirements inserted into the end of the document. You can find those on page 12. Judicial Council staff in information technology, IT, worked with the three pilot courts to review and document the equipment set up used by the two vendors during the pilot. They reviewed the pilot performance for the two vendors as compared to the objectives of the RFP. The three pilot courts' IT staff also worked with JCIT to develop recommended minimum technology requirements for VRI based on the pilot, and the National Center was also retained to help review the recommended requirements, and you can find that information on Attachment B. We did receive some comments as it relates to this project. On December 14th, 2018, the VRI Workstream met via WebEx to review this draft report and the recommended guidelines for VRI. The draft report and guidelines were also shared with all of the members of the Technological Solutions Subcommittee for review and feedback. We concluded there were no major concerns that were raised regarding the drafts, but an interpreter member asked if he could share the draft report and guidelines with CFI for additional review and comment. This request was granted on December 28th. CFI and IGA submitted a joint letter with comments, which are contained on Attachment D. I reviewed these comments carefully with Judge Jessner, who's my co-executive sponsor of the VRI Workstream, and we determined that we disagreed with the letter's characterization that the VRI pilot was not successful and that many of the points raised in the letter were bargaining issues that were not appropriate for the guidelines. CFI and IGA did make many meaningful comments and suggestions regarding best practices that, while not appropriate for general guideline changes, could potentially be woven into the separate VRI best practices document that is currently under development by the National Center as additional resource for courts. We have some recommendations, but before I conclude, I want to stress that our courts need guidelines for appropriate use of VRI, and this work is extremely important to provide guidance for courts and steps on how to ensure effective communication through proper use of VRI for our LEP court users. The goal is to improve LEP court user access to qualified court interpreters and to share our limited resources as needed across the state. To summarize, the report has the following recommendations for the Council on page 2. Number 1, adopt the guidelines in Attachment A for video remote interpreting, which now include guidelines for recommended minimum technology requirements. 2, direct Judicial Council staff to create leverage purchase agreements for courts with the 2 approved VRI vendors that successfully participated in the VRI pilot project. 3, direct Judicial Council staff to begin and implement a coordinated VRI program for the branch in 2019. And direct staff to regularly report on implementation progress of the VRI program to the Council, including any need for refinement of the VRI guidelines, identification of funding needs, and or development of new rules or forms to support appropriate use of VRI. At this time, Justice Quare, I will turn it back to you for any comments or questions on the report.
Thank you, David, for a very thorough report. This is, from my perspective, a really important technology and resource project for our branch, and one that I hope will help us improve the experience of LEP court users and their level of access. I do think that guidelines of some kind are a step forward for the branch, and my hope and expectation is that further improvements will follow in the days to come in terms of just how this project develops and how it ultimately scales if it does. So at this point, I would like to take a moment to ask for any feedback or comments. Any questions for David or for the staff or comments?
Yes, this is Tracy Clark. I do have a couple comments and questions. May I go ahead?
Great. Yeah, thank you, Tracy. Please go ahead.
Thank you. The pilot started February 1st and ended July 31st. I believe Merced and one courtroom in Ventura started mid-January. Were those surveys just removed from the study, or how does that add up?
Tracy, this is Douglas. SDSU started collecting data as of February 1st.
Okay. I think that answers my question. I had another question, too. The point on the cost savings that could not be calculated because we were only using employees. So I just wanted to be clear that Ventura has always used that combination, since we're not CFI, of both contractors and employees for everything. And we did use them, the same combination, for the VRI. We had both employees and contractors. And the reason, from my point of view, that we couldn't calculate cost savings is because we didn't have time to start doing cross assignments with other languages, which is where we were going to start saving on not moving interpreters around the state, but in moving them through cyberspace. So I think that should be clear if my understanding is in agreement with everybody else's.
That's helpful, Tracy. Thank you.
Thank you, Tracy. That's helpful.
Good.
Hi, Janet. Please go ahead.
Hi. Hi. Thank you, sir. I would like to make some comments. First of all, with a heavy heart, I'm going to have to say that a lot of the study involved, unfortunately, it wasn't very inclusive. For example, a lot of the materials that went online, even though I'm part of the work stream, I was never really kind of given. So I'm kind of a little unprepared, because of the fact that it almost seems like bits and pieces were shared and not everything, and were definitely not included in a lot of the meetings. So I just want to say that, first of all, for example, the evaluation of San Diego State, the formal evaluation, which is attachment C, that wasn't shared with us until last week. And I just want to point that out, that any study that excludes it's and is not being inclusive of everybody that is part of the group, especially for a group that is going to be doing people that are going to be representing most of the people that are going to be doing the work, I just don't see that right. I just kind of want to mention that a lot of the stuff that is on here is really not reflected to what a lot of the interpreters have told me. Something that wasn't attached to in comments was after Tyler Nguyen, Gwen expressed and asked for time to share with the union, he also spearheaded a committee or a spearheaded a form of action where he gathered a lot of the interpreters that participated in this VRI project, and they very much disagree with what was collected. In fact, that wasn't shared, but there was a lot of errors, a lot of echoes. In fact, one of the interpreters said that a coordinator told her that the echo was due to a figment of their imagination, and that they were very about that. A lot of interpreters said it was very difficult. The majority of the times they did it consecutively because simultaneous just did not work. That a lot of interpreters on the ground expressed concern to Olivia and to Lisa during the pilot, and that their concerns were not met. They were having a very difficult time. They weren't really sure if they were able to catch everything and they were able to deliver the message. So when we talk about really do LAPs really get meaningful access, I don't know if we can really say that from this study at all. I mean, the only people that would really know if VRI was very effective would be the interpreters. And the only way to actually really judge that is to have two interpreters, one in the courtroom and one doing everything through VRI. I think Ventura was the only courtroom by default that interpreters were in the courtroom and they were serving, they were there to provide access in case somebody refused VRI services, that on their own motion decided to be the check interpreters to see if the VRI interpreter was catching everything, and to no fault of the VRI interpreter because connection was so bad in some occasions that they reported that about 40% of the cases that were ever conducted contain omissions, and up to 20% were serious omissions. So how can we say that it's really meaningful access when there is no control, there is no testing, there is nothing other than somebody who is monolingual saying, oh, yeah, I think that it was definitely effective. I mean, we have LAPs that will just basically nod and shake their heads because they just don't know, they're afraid to communicate what they really felt. And how do they really know that they got the full message of what was said through VRI when they speak one language and what they get is what the interpreter heard, and we're not really sure if the interpreter heard anything? I think that we have to really approach this with a lot of caution. We are playing with people's lives. I know maybe for some of us a traffic ticket might not be a big deal, but for people of limited means, it's a huge deal. And I think that excluding people to having their live interpreter, and let me retract a little bit. I don't want to say that I as an interpreter am against 100% against VRI. I just really against the misuse and misapplication of VRI. I'm very concerned that none of this was tried to you from court to court, which was the whole purpose of VRI, was to bridge that gap. The gap of having remote courts not having their ability to hire an in-person interpreter, and a lot of courts complaining that some of these contract interpreters were charging way too much, yet very little of it was done. All the information that these interpreters, the VRI interpreters, put together, they were very concerned because they felt that their voices were not being heard at all, that they were just being ignored and just basically being hit by a freight train that wasn't going to be stopped. And I think that having this VRI without any limitations, which is having very little, just 6 months of a study, and especially with dealing with people that their lives and liberties can be at stake, is a big mistake. It's no different than building a wall. I hate to say it that way, but I think that the minute, you know, as Dr. King put it, the minute we start being silent, our lives begin to end. And I can't remain silent, even though that, you know, I understand the intention and the spirit of the committee is to provide language access, but I would feel very wrong if I didn't say anything and say, this is probably not the right way to do it, and we probably need to do more studies. We need to do this right if we're going to do it. And I don't think it's much to ask on behalf of the LAPs. And I know that many of you guys think, well, just interpreters, you know, interpreters, they just have a lot of, you know, they don't want to get with the program. They don't want to do this. They don't want to do that. They're very difficult to deal with. Well, I have to say that I'm not just doing it as an interpreter. My father's an LAP. And I can guarantee that over 90% of the interpreters serving right now, working in the courts, have family members that are LAP. So we do speak on behalf, not just as our profession, because we want to do our jobs right and we want to provide the best quality, but also as advocates, because we've been there. We've been those people. We've been to court with these people that are family members and we care very much about. And regardless of what their status is, regardless of where they come from, they deserve something more than just a makeshift, something quick fix, because eventually the Band-Aid will fall off. So I plead to the committee that, you know, approving something like this can be very dangerous, especially for those that cannot speak for themselves. And I think I really plead to the committee to rethink this and to actually hold off on a vote and do more studies and do it right. Thank you.
Thank you, Jenny. Okay, I just want to make sure wanted to see if David or Doug wanted to say anything at this point, or we could just hold off and take some more comments.
Well, one of the things, Justice Cuellar, this is David, if I could just jump in really quickly. I was asked to serve as the chair, although I've been very familiar with the subject matter, certainly the technology and the goals that were sought in looking for different solutions. A few things that really stand out to me as it relates to this project is, number one, I think there was a recognition that the conditions for the use of the VRI had to be appropriate. It's not the solution, but a solution that can be turned to in the event that a need exists in the absence of perhaps another solution. But what was also moving to me was the greater than 50%, significantly greater than 50% level of acknowledgement that it's an effective resource. And that was information that was gleaned from the reports from the court, the judges, the users, and also the evaluation by SDSU on this activity, which is entirely independent. I think that as we start looking at new technologies that are out there, it's important for us to explore and test. And I think that was done effectively. We've used the equipment in a variety of different courts of size, and it seemingly worked well. So I think that I recognize that perhaps we could have adjusted how the information was shared early on, and that's something that we certainly will look to going forward as other opportunities may present themselves. But I can't say that it's a perfect solution or that there even is a perfect solution, but I think that the steps that were undertaken with the study, the duration, is sufficient for us to, you know, reach some conclusion. And that's just my perspective.
Thank you. Let's go to Naomi.
Justice Cuellar.
Thank you.
Oh, I'm sorry. Doug, you have something you want to ask? Briefly?
Yeah, I just wanted to make a few points.
Okay.
One is to David's point is, and we've put this in the council report, we recognize that interpreters had to deal with new equipment and they sometimes got frustrated. But I do want to stress for the task force members that interpreters were part of the evaluation process. So they filled out surveys after each event. Because they primarily were court employee interpreters, they reported issues to their supervisors all throughout the pilot. And the courts and the vendors made changes to equipment and the setup based on interpreter feedback. So the interpreters were very much involved and listened to during the pilot. And then in the technical report on page 25, it actually lists changes that were made based on echo issues or microphone issues. So I just wanted to put that out there on behalf, because we don't have someone from Sacramento or Merced on the task force, but I know that the courts worked very closely with interpreters all throughout the pilot. And I just want to make sure people know that interpreters were part of the evaluation along with judges, court staff, court clerks. So we took in everyone's feedback for this evaluation.
Thank you, Doug. Now going to, oh, I'm sorry. Any last things?
Yeah. I'm just going to share as well. With the work stream, we shared the evaluation plan early on. We also shared the training materials. So I just want to make sure people also know that we tried to be as transparent as possible with how we were running the pilot from the beginning.
Thank you. Much appreciated. Going to Naomi now.
Thank you. I think that what Janet Hudak just said was very courageous. If we think about just the balance of power in this situation, in this meeting, you know, she is female, she is an interpreter, her job is every day helping these people. I think we really need to listen to what she said. The report says that due process issues were not analyzed because they just analyzed whether communications were effective. And they did that by asking either interpreters, not Czech interpreters, but interpreters, or by asking people who did not speak the language. And so they were saying, yes, communications were effective. I don't speak the language. I think we have to be so serious when people's liberty is at stake. 50% is not good enough. The whole purpose of VRI was to save money, yet we did not do a cost-benefit analysis. I therefore think the pilot program was not successful. We should do more study and get that cost-benefit analysis. I think this is really critical, and we're talking about getting other languages online, which is what I have been concerned about since the beginning, which are precisely those indigenous languages that do not culturally want to be on video. So I really ask everybody to take a moment to breathe and think about, wow, somebody really said something from the heart that was very important about LEPs, liberty, no, at risk in the courts. Let's keep having interpretation in person, and let's study this option more. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Naomi, and thank you, Janet, for your intervention. We very much appreciate hearing from you, as we do appreciate hearing from everybody on the task force.
Ms. Claire, this is Judge Covarrubias.
Okay, I heard Judge Covarrubias, and I heard somebody else. Let me just take a quick list. Who was the other person?
Put me on your list.
Okay, so I have Covarrubias, Clark, and Birchfield. Judge Covarrubias, the floor is yours.
Thank you. I would like to say that first I thank Janet for her comments and her participation, not only in the task force, but of the language access implementation plan that was developed. She's always been very insightful and very willing to express her views, which I really appreciate. My take from the study that has been prepared is that it's so critical and important for the equipment to be the appropriate equipment. Because I think it shows that if everything is working properly, that you have the limitations that we've talked about in these case-specific types for these works to work, that the sound system is working appropriately, that people know how to use the equipment, then it can be successful. And I think that's what the purpose of the pilot was, to ensure that. Because I have found, being a judicial officer, having knowledge of both languages, that even if you have a live interpreter, if the sound system isn't working appropriately, interpreters cannot hear and then can't interpret. If you don't have a atmosphere where interpreters feel free to raise their concerns with the court, that our judicial officers need to understand that interpreters need to be able to raise their hand and say, stop the proceedings, I can't hear, because everyone's speaking at the same time, just like in court reporters, that they can't hear because attorneys aren't speaking into the microphones, that then they can't hear, the court can't hear, the process doesn't work, even if you have an interpreter that's in person. So those things are the critical parts, that the appropriate equipment be used, that you have development of these guidelines that have been put on, that what are the qualifications that have to be in place. But if you have a system in place and that it can be successful, that was shown by the study. And that's what the purpose, I think, of the part of it. Certainly a cost is one factor. It was never and never has been intended that will replace the in-person interpreters. Interpreters have been a crucial part of our evaluation of it. And I think it shows that you need to have appropriate equipment that meets the specifications that we need to be able to ensure that everyone is able to hear, that there's a confidentiality about it, that that's in place, and that individuals know how to use that equipment, and they use in case-specific types. I think that's what the crucial thing has been about this, and it shows that if you follow it, what things put in place, that it can be an effective mechanism to provide appropriate language access for the limited English proficient population that we all serve. But certainly, even if we don't follow that in a courtroom with a live interpreter, and you have noise going about in busy courtrooms that I have dealt with through over 20 years of experience, then you need to be able to stop the proceedings, quiet everyone down so everyone can hear. Sound systems are so important when you have interpreters listen in, be it on headsets, be it with appropriate microphones, equipment becomes and technology becomes so important. But I think that's what the survey did. I think that's what the study did, that if it's things are working appropriately in appropriate case types, that it can be an effective tool to be implemented when a live interpreter is not available. Thank you,
Jessica Barrubias. Tracy Clark and then Angie Birchfield.
Your Honor, I'll go ahead and change places with Angie Birchfield, if that's okay with you.
That's fine. Angie Birchfield?
Yes, good morning, everyone. I would like to just piggyback on what was mentioned and try to approach it as from a viewpoint of trying to solve the issues that have been presented. One of my biggest concerns, and has always been throughout this entire pilot project, has been for the interpreter and the certification. The minute that we open our mouth to do VRI, the margin for error increases. And we need to make sure that everyone is aware of that fact when we do these different kinds of events. And that's why I think part of solving this issue is to make sure that the interpreters are involved in the entire process and are allowed to give their feedback from here forward with whatever courts decide that they want to start trying to use the VRI. I think that if the VRI is used for the purposes that it has been stated that it would be used for, then I don't think that we're going to have a problem, especially if the interpreters are allowed to be involved, to be allowed to be part of the training process for the other court users, and to make sure that the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed, and that we keep that margin of error to a minimum, if at all possible. And that's why I think I echo all of the concerns that Janet Hudick presented, as well as what our wonderful Judge Covarrubias has also mentioned. And I think that if we try to work this out together and make sure that we're all inclusive, that we will be able to have some sort of success with this, and specifically for the purposes that this was presented in the first place. And with that, I'd like to thank everyone.
Thank you very much. I'm just going to make a process observation, which is we're at 12:40. We still have one other item. I do know that there are many perspectives about this important issue, and I want to take a moment to hear one to two additional comments if those comments were out there, but at some point we'll probably have to continue the dialogue. So,
Tracy, I just wanted to clarify something. There are several people on this committee who weren't in the original, not the original, but in the meeting we had with the SDSU research team. We had a couple meetings while they were trying, a few actually, but a couple really meaty ones while they were trying to see what kind of information they could measure in a study that would be more quantitative and not just anecdotal. They did a search, for those of you that weren't in these meetings, they did a search, a global search, and I think they just stayed with English reports. But anyway, from stuff coming out of Europe, from stuff in here, from courts, about what was done with VRI. And they had not found anything anywhere with interpreting services that measured an LEP's successful access to justice through an interpreter who was standing right next to them. What they wanted to do, there was a lot of concern about the due process. There continues to be concern about the due process. What the team originally wanted to do was get a base measurement study of how effective due process was to an interpreter standing right next to you, and then see how that compared to an interpreter through VRI. But there were no studies they could find, that anyone could find, and they're a pretty highly qualified team. This is what they do. They couldn't find any studies on an interpreter right next to them. All of us interpreters know anecdotally that we leave sometimes thinking, did I hear that right? That was an awful noisy courtroom. This guy kept coughing next to me, or the person still seemed confused. Was the interpretation not adequate, or is the person just confused for other reasons? There's a whole lot of things that we constantly monitor and try to correct in person, but there's no base study for an interpreter being right next to them that has any kind of academic significance or validity for us to work with for due process through an interpreter. So that's one of the reasons we didn't try to study due process through VRI, because there was no comparative, and our team said that's what was needed. And they weren't hired to do the original study. So it doesn't make the situation any less dire or these comments any less important. But I think it's important to understand why we're not trying to quantitatively evaluate that, because we don't have a base study. And I hope that makes sense.
Thank you, Tracy. I want to see if anybody else who hasn't spoken has a brief comment they'd like to share.
This is Jose Varela. I was on the ASL committee, and so was Tracy and others, when we looked at VRI for American Sign Language. And there was a lot of studies done, but one of the things that did come through in that pilot was an assessment of due process. And it was within the pilot itself, and that is asking participants, did they feel engaged in the process? Were they able to hear things? And one of the things and cautionary tales that we learned from that is that VRI oftentimes is useful in limited circumstances. More complex the subject matter, the less the connection is with the person because of the complexity of the concepts being translated and heard by people. And so my hope is, as we go forward, that we look at due process and start asking the interpreters, the attorneys utilizing the VRI, and the court to determine whether or not, in fact, the important and essential component of this is being met, and that is that the LEP user is, in fact, getting constitutionally protected advocacy through the process and means of VRI. Because I think that in the end, those are going to be the major questions. Some of the issues involving, you know, noise and other things, technology is going to address through headphones and other circumstances that we currently use in the courtroom to minimize noise and things of that nature. But in the end, the consumer and their access to constitutional advocacy, I think, is going to be a very important tool as to the expansive nature of how VRI can be used. So I ask that we keep in mind that that's really the focus of translation, is that legal conversation that goes on between the LEP user and the court system. So thank you very much.
Thank you, Jose. I'm going to ask David to see if he wants to make any last observations before we see if there's a motion to go forward.
I have nothing further to add.
Okay. I want to make just a few brief observations. First, I want to thank everybody who spoke up, and many people who have not spoken on this call have been quite involved in the process in different ways, partly reaching out to staff, partly reaching out to me, partly exchanging paper, partly just simply following up and giving us general feedback. I'm really grateful for all of that feedback. I don't think there is a perfect process. Certainly what we've done, I would not use the term perfection to describe it, but certainly I hope people will join me in recognizing that there's been a very serious attempt to try to include as many voices as reasonably possible in this process. Second, I just want to note that from my perspective, just speaking for myself, but as somebody who's tried to follow this as closely as I can, I feel like a lot of the questions that people have raised are questions that have been very much on our minds from the very beginning. I don't think that going forward with a report like this one in any way suggests that we have to stop thinking about those questions. On the contrary, I think our responsibility to make sure the implementation goes right, that we include interpreters in the process, that we find better ways of assessing how court users are experiencing the entire process as much as possible in a language they can understand, you know, working with a complaint process we have and all that, I think that responsibility will increase. But for what it's worth, if I thought that this report was a first step in replacing the presumption that we mostly try to do this through in-person interpretation, I would not be supportive of it. I don't think that's what the report really does. I think ultimately this is a report about trying to figure out how do we give courts that find this to be useful in their particular context a platform so that they can solve an access to justice problem and doing it as close as possible to what we think will work reasonably, but while continuing to improve as best we can. And last but not least, if this does go forward, I would like to ask the staff to see where they might make various clarifications and changes to make sure that some of the points that have just been mentioned in the call, including, for example, the importance of having interpreters continue to be very much involved and maybe even further involved in advising in the implementation, be included. So with that, I'm going to see if anybody wants to make a motion that we approve the report.
If it's appropriate, Justice Cuellar, may I move approval of the report?
Thank you. You may. Is there a second?
Second.
Thank you.
Justice Cuellar?
Yes.
This is Kevin Baker. Just procedurally, in light of the concerns that have been raised from the interpreters and, you know, just keeping in mind that as we go forward, potentially seeking additional funding to implement VRI, which, you know, I think probably does have to be part of our solution going forward, but there are concerns about whether it is sort of done correctly or not. I'm just wondering if there might procedurally be an opportunity for the concerns of the professional interpreters here to be reflected and represented, and that there seems to be some concern about the accuracy of the information that underlies the report. It just obviously the interpreters are the sort of key stakeholders, I think, along with other judicial officials in making sure that this is implemented properly. And I just want to be sure that they have had an opportunity to provide that kind of input. Is it possible that that this matter could be deferred until those concerns are addressed?
You know, let me give you a really quick response. I'm just thinking out loud a little bit. I'm just reluctant to go in that direction because the task force is almost entirely out of time. We've been doing our best to try to incorporate a lot of different perspectives. I don't think that we can expect that the report will be that there will be equal enthusiasm across the task force about the report itself. But I also think it's important to note that's not the end of the process, right? Like at the end of the day, what we're trying to do is to give the Judicial Council an opportunity to get the benefit of the insights here, recognizing that there are somewhat different perspectives. I do think both David and Doug have spoken a little bit to the various ways that we tried and that the courts that were involved tried to include interpreters and participants. I think San Diego State, you know, did what they could, and to my mind, did their best to bring, as some folks have said, sort of the best that they could find in terms of analysis and precedent to this issue. So my preference at this point would be, like I certainly am happy to hear some further discussion there's been a second, so we are able to have further discussion right now. But I worry about just postponing and trying to get to a point where everybody's happy with every single word. I think that maybe an alternative that I would think would serve the Judicial Council reasonably well is for us to present the report and then for them to have the benefit of any further feedback, recognizing that there are different perspectives on some things. But let me ask David or Doug to weigh in with any other thoughts that they have.
Yeah, I would concur with you, Justice Cuellar, both in the interest of time as well as an opportunity for other commentary to be expressed. I think I'm comfortable going forward as well.
Okay. Any further discussion at this point? Hearing none, I'm going to ask us to go for a vote then, and I would like to ask all those in favor to please say aye.
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 Aye. Okay. All those against?
No.
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 Okay. Any abstentions?
Did I hear Janet and Angie vote no?
Yes.
Naomi voted no.
Okay. And Angie, did you vote no or?
No. I said yes.
Okay, so Janet and Naomi, no. Thank you. Just to clarify.
Any abstentions?
This is Kevin. I'll be abstaining.
Okay. Let me express my appreciation to everybody. I do reiterate that I don't think this is the end of the process. We will continue to review and discuss, but I do think that it'll be good for the Judicial Council to have the benefit of the report. And we will also do our best to convey the substance of the feedback that we've had on this call. We don't have much more time based on what we've scheduled, so let me see if we can address the bilingual volunteer protocol. So let me go straight to Justice Zeland to take that up.
Okay, and at this point, being an ex-New Yorker is going to pay off because I'm going to this document is being presented for your approval and approval for dissemination. It's already on the task force website. It's recommendation number 34 of the Language Access Plan, which calls on courts to consider the use of bilingual community volunteers outside of the courtroom. And obviously, if we are going to use community volunteers, we want to do it in an appropriate way where they understand the rules, the courts understand the rules, and the litigants are protected by that. At the same time, it recognizes that we're already using people in court docent and community customer service programs outside of language. So the intent of this document is to provide guidance and support to local courts that are either developing a program or adding volunteers to existing programs like children's waiting rooms and domestic violence programs. There are 15 guidelines in the categories of recruitment, qualification, training, and supervision and management. There's also information about what's already out there, which should help people think about going forward. And we are asking the task force to approve this document and to approve our plan to distribute it both to the LARs and to put it on the toolkit so that it is available to courts. And I would ask for a motion to approve the protocol.
Sound like a true former New Yorker. Any questions or comments for Justice Zeland? Okay. Hearing none, do we have a motion to approve the bilingual volunteer protocol for posting to the Language Access Toolkit?
Judge Conklin, move to approve.
Thank you. Do I hear a second?
Judge Colbert, a second.
Thank you, Judge. Any further discussion? Okay. Hearing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
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 Okay. All those against? Abstentions? Okay, so it's approved, and I'm really grateful, and we still have about 4 or 5 minutes to wrap up. So let me just make a couple of brief observations, partly about the conversation today, but also partly about the entire Language Access Task Force process. So I am just somewhat overwhelmed at times when I think about the sheer amount of time and energy that people on this task force have put forward to be involved, taking time away from work, from family, making big efforts to leave aside a bunch of other things. And I want to express that, you know, as I contemplate the prospect of no more task force meetings going forward, It's I'm sure the hole in my schedule and in my heart will be filled in various ways, but I just want to note how much I'm grateful to all of you. This has been a tremendous process thanks to your help and your contributions. This is not the time or the place for me to just list in utter detail all the things that we have been working on together and many of the things we've gotten done. We'll have a chance to reflect on that perhaps in the future in different ways. But I just want to note that as I think about everything that we've tried to accomplish together, I'm also very much aware of two things. The first is that a lot of work remains to be done. I still think about those 4 or 5 counties, some of them with not too many judges, some with somewhat more judges that have not been quite as responsive to our surveys. I think about all the data we need to learn how to collect better. I think about how we need to relate to court users in their own language more effectively. I think about all the things we need to do to improve our support for our interpreters, to recruit interpreters with the right language skills into the profession and keep them in the profession. So I do think of this as an ongoing process that will require not only my continued engagement in some form, but very much yours, and I look forward to seeing you stay engaged. Second, I think it, you know, I said this in connection with the VRI report, but I just want to highlight it again. I don't think any of us should ever expect that this process, notwithstanding our shared commitment to access to justice for people who don't speak English, that would mean that we would always agree on everything. And I've tried, not necessarily always with complete success, but certainly tried to be respectful and responsive and to keep the task force that way to the difference of opinions and views. When I touch base with the Chief Justice about this periodically, I try my best to give her a sense of how the mood of the entire task force is playing out. And I am quite confident that the continued progress that we're going to achieve as a state on language access is going to depend on that continued respect for differing points of view and our efforts to try to accommodate them in every way that we can. So with that, let me thank you for your participation and say that I will be in touch with many, if not most of you in the days to come on all these different things that we continue to do. But for the moment, our work on this call is over, and we are ready to adjourn. So thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Thank you. The host has left the meeting. So at this time, the meeting will come to an end. Thank you, and goodbye.